Support for KNKX and Sound Effect comes from WSECU, reminding listeners that WSECU is a local community credit union. WSECU welcomes everyone in the state of Washington who embraces the values of giving, sharing, and supporting local communities. More information can be found at WSECU.org.
This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and right now we're listening to a four-year-old child who is wearing a tiny suit and tie, playing the drums in the KNKX performance studio. He, his father, and grandfather talked to Sound Effect's Jennifer Wing back in April.
Play drums makes me feel like Daddy's playing with me, like just go to school, have fun like school, just play.
Who taught you how to play the drums?
Well, Daddy actually taught me.
I am Devon Lewis. I play drums, music with various bands around town, have my own bands, and that's my son, Donovan Lewis. We have this video, I think he was probably like maybe 3 to 6 months. He had some sticks in his hand, you know, and playing on the carpet. So he and like saying like, so he's making his own song. So yeah, it's been like since he was born. It's our family DNA, music. So it was a given.
I'm Dave Lewis Jr. and this is my son Devon, and that's my grandson Donovan. My grandfather Dave Lewis Sr. taught my father Dave Lewis all that he knew. And this was back in the 50s and 60s where my grandfather taught Quincy Jones, Jimi Hendrix, and Dave Lewis in the basement at his house.
I used to always say, I want to play guitar, you know. And then I seen a picture of my dad on the drums, and then that's when I was like, okay, yeah, I'm going to really take it seriously. So
you remember seeing that picture for the first time?
Yeah, I was a little older, yeah.
Do you still have it?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I know. I should. Yep.
I think Roosevelt was a big influence on you too, Mr. Brown, the jazz program. The jazz program there.
Yeah,
that's where you learned to read music.
How does it feel for the two of you to sit and watch Donovan play and to be so comfortable and so at ease at that drum set? He's only 4 years old.
I just watch in amazement, you know, let him explore on his own, figure it out, you know. You know, the real teaching is going to be teaching him the business part. That's what I told him.
You always do something, like, you always try to pay gigs and money.
Donovan, you're going to be a fine player. That's natural. The real lesson is how to deal with people, how to get to your gig on time, how to be professional, and he'll get it. He'll start coming with me to different. He'll come with me to different shows and he'll play. So we'll have company. He'll start playing. You know, people, friends come over. He'll set up a little set. He's giving a show. He's already ready. He's more of an entertainer than me, but yeah.
Three generations of musicians in one room talking about music. And we have a little musical tradition here at Sound Effect. Every year for our show following the Thanksgiving holiday, we give a listen back to our favorite musical stories from the past year. We'll hear a satirical post-election musical performance and hear from one of the true gospel legends in Seattle. But next, we're going to tell you how music and tragedy intersected on a college campus in Seattle. Marcus Haney is a video producer and photographer. He has captured some big names on film, Elton John, Coldplay. In 2014, Marcus was asked to produce a music video for a British band called Bear's Den. His idea was this: film his younger brother, Turner Haney, and his friends, all students at Seattle Pacific University. Marcus wanted to capture youth on the brink of adulthood. But on June 5th, 2014, the day the filming was set to begin, something horrible happened on SPU's campus. Aaron Ibarra walked onto campus with a shotgun and opened fire. Two people were injured. One was killed. He was 19-year-old Paul Lee, a freshman. Paul was Turner's friend. Turner Haney and his friend Katie Reagan, who was also going to be in the video, sat down with sound effect producer Kevin Kniestad. Turner says the shooting happened as he was picking up his brother Marcus, the photographer, from the airport.
I had to make a stop in Georgetown on the way back to do some repairs on my car. And that's when I was in the waiting room of the auto body place. There's another guy just flipping through the channels and flipped past the news channel and I saw my school. So I told him to go back, and that's where I started knowing what was going on.
I was working at a retail spot downtown, and I overheard a woman in the store talking on the phone with somebody. I couldn't really, like, hear the specifics, but I basically heard, like, they think there was an, you know, armed person on campus. There were shots fired. We don't really know what else is happening. And at that point, I automatically knew, like, somehow that someone that I knew was affected, that something was going down at my school.
I came back and just looked for my friends and, you know, the same friends that we were doing this video with. It was clear that nobody knew anything. We were kind of all just trying to get in touch with whoever we knew.
There were just like floods of phone calls and everyone just trying to keep tabs on everyone that they could immediately think of, making sure that they would answer their phone or that, you know, that they were safe.
We still didn't know who had been injured. So as the night progressed, like there started becoming this conversation forming on my floor in the residence hall. There's one kid that nobody had been able to get in touch with yet. And my roommate pulled me aside. And he was going to be a residence advisor the next year. And so he was kind of privy to this information. He said, keep this down, but it's looking like it may be Paul. Once it got later into the night and we couldn't hear from Paul, a few people pulled their mattresses out and were waiting by the elevator for him. And pretty soon after that, everybody's mattress was out.
It's a really small school. Like if there was, you know, even one person that got injured, you probably know them or you know of them or you know someone that knows them really closely. And so it was just a lot of trying to figure that out and just trying not to go insane while you're doing it.
When did you find out that Paul had been killed?
It was the next day.
I think, yeah, because there were two other students that were in the hospital, and so they didn't release any of the three names until, I think, later the next day.
We were just overloaded, not really knowing how to feel. It didn't feel real.
It was just like, let's all just try to get through it. Like, that's all anyone could really handle at that moment.
Can you tell me about Paul? What was he like?
He was hilarious. He was a riot. he was somebody that everybody just really enjoyed being around. He dressed a little thuggy, but he was just the nicest guy. He was always the life of the party. He was a great dancer. He loved to dance.
Even if you didn't know Paul, you knew that he danced.
Yeah.
And you had probably seen a video of him dancing at some point.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
How did you guys sort of cope initially?
We wanted to be together. It was the cast of this music video, but it was the cast because we were close friends. It just kind of happened to be that we all knew Paul. So we just kind of needed each other and just needed to be together.
So when did the conversation happen with your brother about whether or not you guys were going to still do this?
I think I brought that up the day after the shooting, you know, in the context of maybe doing it, but doing it for Paul. This is, you know, a unique situation, and right now we have the platform to do something significant and maybe show the public an intimate view of what a school shooting looks like from the inside.
And I mean, Marcus was really great about it. we all sat down the night after the shooting, and he's like, hey guys, like, this is probably the worst situation that is, or the worst thing that's happened to a lot of you. So if you're out, no hard feelings. But if you want to do this, it's going to be awesome. And it's going to be one of the worst weeks of your life, but we're going to try to make something good out of it.
That was when we really started listening to the song and listening to the lyrics. The name of the song is Elysium, and it's by Bear's Den. The opening lyrics are, brother, do you believe in an afterlife?
Brother, do you believe in an afterlife? Where our souls will both collide in some great Elysium, way up in the sky.
That was another reason that we decided to do this video, was that somehow it became so relevant and so applicable to the situation.
For the next 3 days, it was on, and that was what we were listening to, and that was kind of a way to, I don't know how it happened, but that song was meant for that scenario, and just the fact that we got to experience it and that we got to, you know, listen to that song and really process through it, I think was just incredible.
Every page I turn, I only find myself feeling.
What happened next?
Marcus would put us in situations and just let us do what we were going to do, except now there was this element of us doing it for a purpose. What came through was this video of, you know, you can see us kind of needing each other there. Just like another dimension to what it would have been. There's this close group of friends that's loyal to each other, but now they need each other.
Is there a moment in this video that's personal to you or stands out to you?
There's like one little scene. We were all inside one of our friends' houses, and we were kind of dancing around, and we were playing, and we were flipping through the TV, and we found a news station that was playing footage from our school that had happened 2 days before. And we all just kind of stopped and, you know, stopped mid-dance move, you know, mid-drink, whatever, and just kind of like stared at the TV for, you know, a solid 5 minutes, just in complete silence. And I look over to my friend Natalie, who's in the video, and we both just start crying, and I hug her. And that's kind of like the turning point of the whole video, where it kind of goes into the grieving and the sadness that we were all feeling. You know, I have that clip in my brain, and I, you know, play it back very regularly. And it was just this horrible kind of realization that, like, yep, this still happened. This wasn't a dream. Like, this is actually going on.
You know, there were times where, you know, crying just didn't fit anymore. And so we'd just be talking about Paul and just laughing, laughing our ass off at the that he pulled.
One of the scenes that sort of jumps out to me in this video, too, is when you put a sweatshirt down.
Mm-hmm. I made a stencil that said, Dance, Paul, and spray painted it white on the back of the sweatshirt. And the end scene where we're walking and we end up at the memorial and the flowers and the candles and the notes with people still all around it, just laying that down and leaving that for Paul. That was something, you know, I was going to do regardless. I'm glad that I just barely had enough time to make it a part of the video.
Just hold on against the night. Guard your hope with your life.
You both said that, you know, if you guys were going to do this, you wanted to do it for Paul. Was that successful?
Yes. The biggest thing for me was, this is probably going to reach Paul's family, Paul's brother. How are they going to view this? And I never felt fully at peace about the video until over a year later. My brother forwarded me an email that he got from Paul's brother. And that was the point that justified it all for me. I don't care what people on YouTube think, or whether they think it's a good video, or whether they think we're hipster kids taking advantage of a situation. If Paul's brother thanked us for the video, that's what I was looking for. Just hold out against the night.
Guard your hope with your life.
Turner Haney and Katie Reagan spoke with sound effect producer Kevin Kniestedt. To see the music video they were featured in, go to our website, knkxsoundeffect.org.
The cold wind made your cheeks glow, shivering away under your coat. Berlin was all covered in snow. All I could offer was a hand to hold. So we made our way to the memorial. You traced your hand.
Welcome back to Sound Effect on KNKX 88.5. Gabriel Spitzer here, and today is our annual show listening back to some of our favorite music stories from the last year. Now we're going to look at how the 2016 presidential election transformed the political narrative through music. Seattle musician John Roderick is the frontman for the indie rock band The Long Winters. He's a liberal guy. You might remember his bid for Seattle City Council that fell short in 2015. But in 2016, he wrote an anthem in response to the Trump campaign called Make America Great Again. It was part of author Dave Eggers' project, 30 Days, 30 Songs, which called on musicians to write songs for a new post-election America. Most artists wrote straightforward protest songs, but John decided on a satirical take. He sat down with sound effect producer Ali Ferguson to talk about why he went a different route.
Well, I watch the news and I know what's what. I go to rock and worship and I pray. And I see the whole world falling apart. And I thank God I live in the USA.
It's a common problem, I think, for conservative politicians that they want to use rock and roll music in their campaigns. And rock and roll musicians typically do not want their music used by conservative politicians. But I tried to write a song in the voice of a Trump supporter.
Would you have been okay if you heard it at a Trump rally?
Absolutely.
And we want someone to make America great again.
I'm still hoping that it's a big hit on conservative radio, because the challenge, of course, was that I started to write it in a satirical voice, and I wanted it to not be smug, which is a complaint lobbied against the left. And right about the time that I was thinking of it, I went home to Alaska, where I grew up, for my high school reunion. And here I am in this, you know, reunion context with all these people I grew up with, and I know them intimately in the way you can only know someone you've known for decades. And they all are Trump supporters, or a lot of them are. And so they're teasing me because I'm known as the liberal agitator. And they're like, Roderick, you know, you're going to see in November how it's going to go. And I was like, I think you guys are wrong. You know, I had a pretty confident picture of how America looked, which turned out to be wrong. But as the weekend bumbled along, I like all these people. These are my high school friends. I know where they're coming from. And I noticed that they felt like they were the fun people. Mm-hmm. That liberals were nags and scolds and, you know, humorless cultural bullies. You know, rock and roll belonged to them. They were the fun Americans. And so I was inspired kind of by the spirit of their own logic and their kind of rationalization about how uncomplicated their world is. Mm-hmm. And our world is so overcomplicated. And so I started to write the song and found it not that hard to inhabit the worldview.
Well, I'm no gun nut, but I protect my family. And I'm not racist, but my heritage makes me proud. My wife's no feminist, but she knows how to treat her man. And we want someone to make America great again.
I've played this song for a lot of Trump voters, and they accept it whole cloth. Like, yep, that's exactly where I'm coming from. Who is this amazing artist and where do I buy his record?
I'm wondering, kind of getting at the nugget of that, is there something about songwriting that allows you to feel more empathy for the person you're trying to write the song for? Is that what allowed you to kind of feel that relation to someone who's a Trump supporter?
Yeah, because it's in the chords, it's in the voice. I tried for a long time to sing it really straight, with no contractions, you know, no drawl.
Not play up any sort of Southern stereotype.
No, kind of like, ham and nam and nerp.
Yeah.
Just like, this is me in my voice straight. And the lyrics and the music don't allow it. I mean, I ended up drawling, and at a certain point I had to stop fighting. You know, like so much of songwriting is just it comes down from the sky, and you go, where did that come from? And as I was trying to do what I did, which is find a song in its tone and content that would appeal to my high school friends, the rest sort of followed. I think that's why when I play that song live, the few times I have, it elicits gasps.
Because it feels so authentic.
Yeah, and it started to feel that way to me. I could have written 40 verses.
And so how did this affect your perception of the election and then the ultimate outcome?
You know, I was so wrong about the election and about what I thought was the, you know, the constituent underlying truth of America and where we were right now, that I realized I needed to be quiet for a little bit because I had the same instinct that everybody did, which was to weigh immediately back in and say, well, I was completely wrong, except all of the ideas that I had that led me to that wrong conclusion, those ideas are still right. And so I'm just going to just start vociferously advocating for exactly the stuff I was advocating for yesterday, except with no doubt about it. And I realized I couldn't do it. I needed to express some self-doubt. And I started to see the cracks a little bit, not in any of our major ideas, which I still believe, but in the methodology.
Implementation and sort of the activism of it?
I think in a lot of ways it's just the tone. The tone of condescending certitude. And writing this song, I don't sympathize with a single idea that I promulgate in the lyrics. But I do empathize in the sense that I can hear that. I can hear that voice. Right, you're not a gun nut. Sorry I called you a gun nut. I know you just think you're protecting your family. I get it, you know. The difference of opinion we have is that I think guns should be registered and you should have to take a class and get a license. You see that as an impingement upon your freedom. Now the laws are all going so-called politically correct, where less qualified applicants get the jobs. It was traditional values what built this country. Without help from you, East Coast college snobs.
But do you think something like this song, which would be heard mostly by liberals, allows them to create some sort of empathy for that idea that I'm no gun nut, but I do want to protect my family?
Hopefully.
You would hope so?
I don't think that the way forward is that we continue to sneer at each other.
So if something like a song can create that sort of shared empathy, do you think maybe the solution is we just need more conservative songwriters?
There are plenty of conservative songwriters. It's just that they're all happening in the mainstream country world that most listeners of this program aren't dipping their toes into.
That was local musician John Roderick talking with producer Ali Ferguson. You can watch a video of John performing his song Make America Great Again at the KNKX Studios on the Sound Effect Facebook page. If you're just joining us, this is Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today we're revisiting our favorite music stories from the last year. Paul Caldwell is the artistic director of the Seattle Women's Chorus and the Seattle Men's Chorus. The fact that he's here, conducting with his right arm, is incredible, given what happened to him about a year and a half ago. On April 3rd of 2016, Paul was living in Chicago. He was planning his move to Seattle to take the job he has now. He was walking home to his apartment after having dinner with his best friend the kind of friend that makes you homemade chicken pot pie. And as Paul was crossing the street, he was struck by a speeding car. Arms and legs that worked just fine a moment before were now a tangle of broken bones, skin, and blood. Sound Effects' Jennifer Wing talked to Paul last March. He told her he remembers everything, including what he was carrying, a beautiful leather satchel
that someone had made for me 20 years earlier, and I had carried my sheet music in it every day to work for years. And when the impact happened, the satchel actually flew up and hit me in the face. But when my face went down onto the pavement, the satchel was actually between my face and the asphalt. So the buckle on the satchel broke my nose, and there was a pretty big cut. But that's the thing that saved me, the fact that my head didn't actually impact the pavement. My arm did and was pretty badly mangled. My foot was caught in the wheel well of the car and went around three times. The rear wheel ran over my left arm. It miraculously didn't break. It was the right arm that hit the pavement that was messed up so badly.
And what did the driver do?
He sped away. I went to a hospital that night. I was received through the emergency room. I was there for many hours. They sent me to surgery. The bones were all sticking out. As a matter of fact, the arm, they couldn't do anything for it because there's this thing that is called road rash that I never heard of, and that means that the tissue from the arm had been stripped away, the muscle and the skin, to the point that they couldn't create a surgical closure. So all they could do was immobilize it and wait for 3 weeks until they could hopefully do reconstructive surgery, which enough tissue had regenerated by that time that they were able to. But I remember going into the first surgery for the arm not knowing, like there was a question mark. When we take the dressing off, will we be able to do the surgery or will we not? We don't know. There's a scar on my left arm, which is the one that wasn't broken, but I have photographs of tire tracks on the arm. And then when the bruises came up, it was really clear, like you can see the imprint of a tire, but the arm didn't break.
It's amazing that your satchel broke the blow.
Yeah. Yeah. The music saved my life. Literally. It was a satchel full of sheet music. So when people say music saved my life, it's true. It did. I woke up the next day in the hospital. I had no idea that within a week I would be transferred to a nursing home, because I wasn't able to care for myself and I needed 24-hour care. And when I went to the nursing home, I guess I thought, you know, I'd be there a week or two. I had no idea, you know, that I would be there for weeks and months, and that when I was released from the nursing home, I was still going to need 24-hour care. And I just had no way of comprehending this. It has been a mess and it's been a journey, but also it's been an opportunity for me to experience kindnesses in the world and gifts that I never would have known otherwise. I mean, the way people showed up for me, and it wasn't always the people that I would have expected to show up for me.
Who were some of the surprises?
Well, when I came to in the hospital after surgery the next morning, there were people from the Windy City Gay Chorus who were already there. They fed me. They sat on the side of my bed. They cut my meat. They washed me, you know. And these weren't people, I mean, I knew these people because they sang in my chorus, but they weren't like close friends that I would expect to wash me. So that's one of the things that happened. Another one of the things that was really profoundly life-changing is I said earlier that I was at my best friend's house for dinner. This was a routine we had every Sunday after my rehearsal. I went straight to his house for dinner, and we had been best friends for years. But I was in the hospital, and I watched him. He came to the emergency room even before I was in surgery. He was there the next day when I came out of surgery, and except when he had to work, he basically never left me for months. And I looked up at him from the hospital bed one day and said what I had been thinking at that point for weeks, and that is, I love you, and I don't want to spend my life without you. And I think at that time he thought I had had too much pain medication, you know, that I had completely lost it, but now we're engaged and he lives with me and we're going to be married in July. And that's something that I can honestly say I wouldn't have been brave enough to say that to him or to make that happen if this hadn't happened to me. I mean, so as horrible as it is, one of the greatest gifts that I know in life is a direct result of that.
What other things are you saying that before the accident, before April 3rd, you wouldn't have said?
I think before then, I was much more focused on Paul Caldwell, the conductor, Paul Caldwell, the person, Paul Caldwell, the guy with the career, Paul Caldwell, the guy whose name was on printed sheet music because he wrote it. And what happened after that is I really became Paul, the person. I care far more about spending time with people now, people who care about me and people who care about the world and care about other people. That's where I want to invest my energy. The other thing that I understand more clearly now is just the whole issue of scars. You know, everyone has them. And I don't think I really understood that before. I mean, I have a difficult time looking in the mirror when I take my clothes off because as much as we try to make me look, you know, like a normal guy, I really don't. And it's painful to see that. And it's just made me more sensitive to the scars that everyone has.
Are you talking about physical and emotional scars?
Yes, I'm talking about all the kinds of scars.
What music have you listened to along the way as you have healed your broken bones, gone through physical therapy? Can you share with us some of the music that has supported you?
Yeah, music of the world. There's a Portuguese singer named Dulce Ponch. And she's sort of inspired by the tradition of fado, which is the literary equivalent of the blues in Portugal. I mean, the music isn't the blues at all, but it's all wearing my feelings on my sleeve and my pain is really great. That's sort of the overarching theme there. I love her voice. It's incredibly beautiful. I can't listen to it enough.
What was it like when you conducted for the first time after the accident?
Well, it was the Seattle Women's Chorus in October. That was the first time I went on stage. When I came to Seattle in October, I started conducting rehearsals, and at that time I was still in a wheelchair a lot of the time. I was really, really determined to walk on stage for my first performance. That was at St. Mark's Cathedral, and there's kind of a long aisle, the aisle that every bride dreams of. But me, as, you know, the dude who really can't walk very well, I was like, oh my God, that's a long aisle. So what I did was I asked these two lesbians, older women, who were sort of trailblazers in the marriage equality fight in the state of Washington. I asked them if they would each hold one of my hands and walk me down the aisle. And they did. They came to every single concert and they walked me down the aisle and then helped me up onto the podium. And then when it was time for me to leave, I would take their hand and they would walk me back down the aisle.
And you were able to use your arm.
There was a time when some movements I couldn't do, or it would take me longer to move my arm to the right than it did to move my arm to the left. And that doesn't really work in music because you have to keep a steady beat. So I just remember being thrilled at some point a week or two before the first concert when I realized that the arm actually moved again. There are some things I can't do with it. I can't scratch my ear, but I can conduct. So yeah.
So the music that filled the satchel your head landed on instead of the concrete, do you remember what sheet music that was?
I could tell you probably every song. My chorus was rehearsing for a festival, so that's the music I had. in my bag. My favorite song in there is a song by Ann Hampton Callaway called I Love You More. And it's a dialogue between a mother, Jane Clementi, and her memory of her son's voice.
The shadow of two sycamores reaching out across the floor, and in the half light of my mind,
her son jumped from the George Washington Bridge 3 weeks into his freshman year in college after being publicly humiliated for being gay. So that song was in my folder. Recently, I opened moving boxes that had been delivered straight to the office of the Seattle Women's Chorus and Seattle Men's Chorus, and I just started to cry, and the woman whose office is across the hall from me came in to see what was wrong, and the movers had taken that folder of those songs and put it in that box. And here I was in the office in Seattle finding the binder of songs that had been in that bag.
Will any of the music that was in that satchel and in the box that you later opened in the office, will any of that music be heard at your wedding?
Will any of the music be heard at my wedding? I never thought of that. Maybe it should be. Maybe it should be. I hadn't thought of it.
Let us know.
I will.
Paul Caldwell talked with 88.5's Jennifer Wing. Welcome back. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today it's our annual tradition of listening back to some of our favorite music segments from the last year. Seattle's Total Experience Gospel Choir performs for presidents. It travels all over the world, and its founder is Pastor Pat Wright. She's also the choir's director. Now, Pastor Wright has done other things. She was a DJ, she recorded R&B songs, but she's best known for her work with the choir, which has been around for 43 years. Contributor Eula Scott Bino talked with Pastor Wright about how the choir got started, its importance to her, and when Pastor Wright first knew she could sing.
I was 3 years old, and I was singing around the house, and my father was the pastor of the church, mm-hmm. and my mother was a school teacher. And out of the eight kids, they heard me just singing everything at age three. In the kitchen, and outdoors, playing, whatever I was doing, I was always singing. And that's how my father said one Sunday morning in church, he said, "My baby has something to do for you." And so you want me to imitate it?
Yeah.
Okay, here I am, 3 years old, right?
Okay.
"I don't want to sing, Daddy." He said, "Come on, baby, do it for Daddy." "Okay. Jesus love me, this I know." And that's how it started.
Yeah. Can you describe the Total Experience Gospel Choir for me, how it came to be, and you know how it's formed into what it is today?
It started out as a high school choir at Franklin High School back in 1973. I had been teaching there for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Music.
Oh,
and
wow.
I don't read music. I know nothing. I can't read music at all.
Oh, wow.
No.
How do you move everything around
and
arrange
it? It's just a natural gift.
Yeah.
So the black kids were not going to the Bel Canto Choir. They just refused to get in it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's when they called me. They had heard me on, somebody had heard me on the radio talking about gospel music, and they asked me to come in and interview.
Right.
And I did, and the principal then mm-hmm. said to me, "I don't care what they say. I want you to work here."
Yeah.
And so when we started the choir class in 1972, I couldn't take all the kids who wanted to get in the choir.
Mm-hmm.
And we had over 100 black kids trying to get in that choir room, which only had 60 kids.
Yeah.
And I said to them, "I'm sorry, we just can't take everybody." And at that point, I was going to Mount Zion Baptist Church here in Seattle,
mm-hmm.
right on the corner of 19th and Madison.
Right.
And I talked to Reverend McKinney, who was the pastor then. And I said to him, "May I bring our choir rehearsals to the church, because the church is big enough to handle all the kids who are interested?"
Right.
He said, "Yeah, bring them on.
Yeah.
So I ended up with 112 kids the very first night. Oh, my gosh.
Were they all from Franklin? Or was, I mean, I imagine everybody from Garfield spread. Heard by then.
Oh, the word spread all over the place. And
yeah.
All these kids. I said, oh, my God, what am I going to do with all these kids?
Right.
I need help.
Yeah.
So I called up my good friend Jessica Howard and my friend Susie Brooks, and I said, come help me with these kids. And Robert Stevens, who worked in the school system as well, and he came, and they were our first chaperones.
Oh, that sounds amazing.
Yeah.
How many people are in your choir today?
26.
Wow. What has been able to keep its longevity going and keep it up for this long?
The Total Experience Choir is not supposed to still be together.
Why?
We were ostracized and criticized because the young people wouldn't sing in their church choirs.
Mm-hmm.
But I had them lined up waiting to get into Total Experience.
Well, what do you think the difference was?
Because I didn't preach to them. They
right.
came in to do the music. Plus, our music, I choreographed all of our music.
Mm-hmm.
And the kids loved that.
I imagine it was such like up-tempo and fun.
Oh, yes, that's right.
Yeah.
They don't know that heavy stuff. They're kids.
Right.
That's
yeah.
the problem with churches right now. You can't make old folks out of young people.
Right.
You have your music director has to find music that they can identify with.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like if it wasn't for you saying, let's keep it going, it wouldn't have survived.
No, it wouldn't have succeeded.
Yeah. And do you feel like there's a plus to you not having a like stagnant church or a stagnant school because you're able to?
Well, I'm glad I'm out of the schools, to tell you the truth, because we had so many parents who were complaining because it was gospel music.
Mm-hmm.
But they should have let their kids stay in because some of them would probably be still living today.
Right. Right.
Because they got into a lot of junk out there.
Yeah.
And I stress education.
Mm-hmm.
Especially for African-American children. I beat it in them.
Right.
You can't make it without some kind of piece of paper, okay? And I don't mean a piece of paper to say you just got out of jail.
Yeah.
And many of them have gone on to become great. And the two kids that I have, my son is ours. My daughter I adopted out of the Total Experience Choir at age 14.
Oh, wow.
I took her to her foster parents' home as I dropped kids off after rehearsal. And they wouldn't let her in. And I said to her, get back in this van,
mm-hmm.
and you'll never have to go there again unless you want to.
Right.
And so she never went back.
Yeah.
And now I'm so proud of her.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
And there's so many stories like that. We've already been to 28 countries in 33 states.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
That's beautiful. You know, it's a trip, too, because I think about how, you know, when you have a calling to something like, you know, to ministry or to music,
mm-hmm.
it can be hard to make a living doing it, I imagine.
Oh, you don't make it doing gospel.
Yeah, but you have.
I've never made any money singing gospel music. I made my money when I was singing music. It was all R&B.
Right.
I have my little 45 went to the top of the chart here.
What?
Yeah.
What was the song?
Ooh, I let a good man go.
Sounds amazing.
Yeah. And it's Patronelle Staten. I used my maiden name at that point.
Okay. I read somewhere, too, that you performed at Jimi Hendrix's funeral.
I was the one who performed for him. When he passed away, this family got in touch with me right away.
Yeah.
And asked me if I would sing. I knew his mom.
Oh, that's too good.
Right.
That's beautiful.
And I've sang for three presidents myself, the national anthem.
That's amazing. Did you meet Obama?
Yeah, I did.
What was that like?
Uh-oh.
Were you giddy?
Like a little kid.
Oh, I could only imagine. Was he smooth?
Oh, it's a baby's booty. Yeah, when he came to Seattle, we did the anthem for him.
Oh, that sounds amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you did the Black National Anthem?
We did both of the anthems.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Can you sing some of the Black National Anthem?
Sure. Lift every voice and sing till earth and heaven ring. Let it ring with the harmonies of liberty. Let
rise high as the listening skies. Then let it resound loud as the rolling sea.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Oh, I appreciate you. What does this choir mean to you?
They're my children. And although the makeup of the choir has changed completely, I was all these black children. Mm-hmm. And now it's all white adults, with the exception of four.
Yeah. But do you relate to them the same way? Does it feel the
same? I do. They tell me, well, sometimes you talk just like real children. I say, you don't like it? And they'll say, well, yeah, I like it.
It's nice to have guidance. It's nice to have somebody looking out for you and telling you what to do.
Well, it's not your culture.
Right.
And so I have to teach you how to feel it. Music and have to make that and own that music for yourself. Mm-hmm. I said, just imagine that if I'm singing a song called Precious Lord, which is Thomas A. Dorsey's number one hit and is still most requested funeral hymn that we do.
Leave me alone.
I said, picture yourself losing one of your children.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody gets up and starts doing hip-hop or something.
Yeah.
No, that's no comfort.
Yeah.
I said, but the words to Precious Lord will help you to accept, although you will never, ever get over it.
Yeah.
But accept the fact that this person is, the opportunity to see this person again mm-hmm. is very real.
Right.
And this song will teach you how.
Yeah.
This gentleman who was pretty well off came and joined, and he was a history teacher.
Mm-hmm.
So he knew all the history of the music, so he thought. And I said to him, you ever been to a black funeral? He said, no. I said, then you don't know the history. He said, what does that mean? I said, next time somebody passes away, one of the elders, I'm going to tell you, come go with me. Then you'll understand black history. And so after the funeral was over, he said to me, I went to school today.
Mm-hmm.
I said, yes, you did.
Everything that you've talked about today has really led you to singing and teaching. Do you think that you could live a life where you weren't doing one or the other?
No.
Wouldn't
I
work.
Don't. I, and this may sound a little bit morbid, but I can see myself passing away singing and catapulted.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be sad when I leave.
No, you're going home.
Yeah, I'm going home.
Yeah. That's good. You're going to go up there and sing and teach?
Yeah, I'm going to show the angels how to do the electric slide.
Sounds like a good time.
That was Eula Scott Bino talking with Pastor Pat Wright. That'll do it for our annual music show. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestead and Jennifer Wing. We got help this week from Allie Ferguson, Eula Scott Bino, and John Kessler. Parker Miles Blom helps with photos and videos, and our executive producer is Aaron Hennessy. You can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or wherever you do that sort of thing. You can see videos of the musical performances you hear on our show at our Facebook page. Just search KNKX Sound Effect. You can also write us at soundeffect@knkx.org. And come on back next week when our theme is In Traffic. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KNKX.